This talk was given by Prabhu Gikan Vasan at Zen Mountain Monastery. Gikan is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Gikan, and I was asked to offer today's talk. I hope everyone's session is going well. I hope this container is allowing you to fully inhabit this container, you know, just leaving what you can of your life and really putting yourself into this life, right? This life that we're creating together. And for those who are joining us from outside, good morning, afternoon, evening, night, whatever it is for you. And if you're doing the home session, I really hope you're able to take this container and bring it into the activities and circumstances of your life as best as you can. I want to start with a few lines from a poem. I'll just start with the lines and then I'll add in some context. Pain has nothing to do with pain. Desperation has nothing to do with desperation. The words we use to mean those things are contaminated. There are no words in the mute place. So these lines were written by the Chilean poet Enrique Lin. He's not well known here, but he's highly regarded in Chile and South America. And these lines are from his final book. And he wrote this book in the final, I think the last couple of months that he was dying of cancer. And you know, it's a fascinating book. You know, poem after poem, he's trying just various ways of coming to terms with this, right? You know, kind of holding up his life, which was coming to an end, to his death, which was kind of coming to a beginning, so to speak, right? And these particular lines drew me. First off, you know, as some of you know, I poetry has been a huge part of my life for a long time, actually longer than Dharma practice, actually. And I like Enrique Lin's work, and you know, it just struck me that his life of language. I mean, he didn't just write poems; he wrote like novels, plays, essays. He wrote comic books. You know, I mean, this is a guy who like invested himself in a life of language to the most refined degree. And it struck me that, despite all that, or maybe because of it, right, at that stage in his life, this is where he arrived. Right, he arrived at a place that is kind of familiar, right, maybe to us, right? You know, if I had said those lines and said that it was from, like, a Buddhist poem, it would have landed okay, right? Just so he arrived in a place that was also kind of, it resonated with, you know, what I do here, right? So I want to look at some of what he wrote, as just maybe as a springboard, right? You know, I was sort of struck, you know, what does it mean to say that pain has nothing to do with pain? What's this mute place that, you know, he, at this part of his life, he seems to have landed at, right? This place without words. And what's the contamination? Let's just back it up a step. And I want to say at the outset that, you know, he used pain, right, and desperation, because of the particular circumstances that he was writing out of, and that might hit home for some of us, but if it doesn't, we can substitute any other word for those words. Right? Happiness has nothing to do with happiness. The pain in your knee has nothing to do with the pain in your knee. The breath has nothing to do with the breath. Whatever side you happen to be on any issue, you can put that in there. You can put whatever side the opposition is on any issue, right? You can even put your name in there, right? Gikan has nothing to do with Gikan. So maybe as a way to kind of enter this, I just like if you would indulge me, I would just like all of us to just take a moment and think back to when you first heard the Heart Sutra. All right, this might not be that long for some of you, but it might be a long time for other people. But just think back to when you first heard it, and maybe, you know, like the very first time you hear it, it's like a big blur, right? Because like you're here for the first time, there's like bowing, there's bells, there's incense, it's all weird and everything. So maybe not that time, right? But when all that stuff just kind of acclimated to it, right? So you're really able to hear the Heart Sutra, right, for the first time, maybe that time. What did you make of all the no's? All those no's. And what did you make of it? And I think it's a singular moment, right? Sometimes on a Sunday when I'm here and I kind of know that who the new people are, when we're chanting the Heart Sutra, I'll just sort of look up and just sort of like just kind of discreetly, like just watch them as we're hitting those no's, right? And just sort of, and just wonder, what's going through them? Right, they're here for the first time, right? They're just kind of reading this and, you know, taking it in first or second time. What must it be like for them? I didn't know what to make of it. I obviously didn't understand it, but it just seemed like there was an awful lot that was being said no to, like everything, right? I remember way back, I started practice when I was in social work school and we were studying like human development. And at one of these early times, I had this image of like Avalokiteshvara almost being like the consummate toddler who just says no to everything, you know, like no broccoli, no nap time, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue. It's like, you know, it's like, I didn't know what to make of it, you know. And when I first began practicing, I remember I was hanging out with some. This is maybe going back like 20 years. I was hanging out with some of my friends, some of my really old friends, and I was telling them about the monastery. Yeah, we come to the monastery, we do zazen, and they're like, "So you keep going back? Like, do you like it?" I said, "Yeah, I really do. You know, it lands with me." I might have even done my first session, and I remember I said, "I want to keep going back. I want to keep doing this stuff." And one of my friends, Jeff, Big Jeff. He said something like, "Well, when you find out that nothing exists, come back and tell us about it," you know. And I really had no response. Right? I it didn't sound right. Right? I'm like, that can't be what Buddhism is about. But but the Heart Sutra, right? All those no's. You know, I didn't know what to say. Because you know, once you say no to everything out there. Right, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, phenomena, and when you say no to everything in here, right, sensation, conception, discrimination, awareness, realms of sight, realms of consciousness, and then when you say no to everything that connects what's in here to what's out there, right, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, when you say no to all that, well, first, how could you even do that? How can you really say no to the most obvious and evident things that make up like our lives? And even if you did do that, what could possibly be left? So this was a point of confusion, obviously, some moments of frustration for a long time, right? Like up until like a long time, a long time. But it turns out that was actually exactly the right question to be asking. And when I stop affirming everything I've been affirming, consciously or otherwise, right? When I can put that down, what am I left with? I recently had an opportunity to witness this happening in real time. As some of you probably know, my mom passed away about a month and a half ago, and she was actually had dementia for at least a couple of years prior to her passing. And you know, one thing that I learned is that essentially dementia is no, 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 over and over and over and over again. by degrees, I really saw my mom's mind, or in her case, I guess physically, like her brain, saying no to more and more of who she was. Right? Not just those core elements of accomplishments and fulfillment and all the stuff, but literally the no to the ways that she had made basic sense of the world. You know, my mom was a huge traveler. She visited dozens and dozens and dozens of countries all over the world. And I sort of saw, you know, no travel and actually no memories of her travels. I remember the first time I asked her, so what's the most favorite place that you've ever visited? And early on, you know, she could kind of produce an answer, but eventually, no. My mom was a scientist, right? She was worked in pharmaceutical companies. No more science. No more ability to understand science. My mom was a huge reader. My love of books comes exactly from my mom. Thank you, Mom. No books. No ability to read, no long-term memory, no short-term memory, no, you know, conversation, right? There was a point where my mom was essentially giving me kind of rote answers to everything I'd ask, which was fine, I could work with that. But then even no more rote answers. In a way, you know, is this what Avalokiteshvara was saying? No, but does what Avalokiteshvara says encompass this? Yes. In a way, it sort of points to this. Okay, you know, it probably bears pointing out that, you know, Buddhism doesn't deny existence. Okay, Big Jeff, if you're like listening to this right now, I just want to know that you were wrong. Wise ass. Buddhism does not say that nothing exists. Just want to clarify that for Big Jeff. Thank you. But what the Heart Sutra does is it doesn't deny that things exist, but it points out something really important for us to understand about existence, right? About all this. Right? What it points out is that all of this depends basically on an outside and inside and what connects them and our ability to make sense of them. And even the notion and recognition of outside and inside and all that stuff depends on further notions and further arrangements of thought and further sense making. And when any of that changes, when those constructs change, like it did for my mom, like it did for Enrique Lin at this stage in his life, right? When any of that changes, our world changes. Our reality, what counts as existence for us, changes. And in Buddhism, of course, we locate all of that in the skandhas. And for those who are relatively new, very briefly, the skandhas are the sensory and mental functions that allow us to recognize, assimilate, and make sense of our world. Very simple. Okay. In the Heart Sutra, it's form, sensation, conception, discrimination, awareness. That's the skandhas. In his commentary on the Heart Sutra, you know, Red Pine kind of points to why this is so important, right? He says, basically, the skandhas represent an attempt to exhaust the possible paths we might take in our search for a self, for something permanent or pure or separate in the undifferentiated flux of experience. This is why Avalokiteshvara looks upon the five skandhas. The skandhas are the limit of reality. If we are going to find anything real, this is where we're going to find it. That's what we're doing here in Sesshin. We're essentially doing what Avalokiteshvara did. We're looking out on the skandhas. We're looking out on all the constructions, right? In the Perfection of Wisdom literature, it's actually called, like Red Pine says, the limit of reality. It's actually called the reality limit. I mean, that's an actual term. right? And when I looked it up, it really, it is that limit that we can know anything. Right? And so we look at that, and we look to find anything real. And we start with the gross stuff, right? The gross constructs, right? Like when you first come in here for beginning instruction, you start to see, you know, your mind's a total mess because it's always been a mess, but now you're seeing that it's a mess. So what do? You say no to that, right? You see it, you let it go. Essentially, you're saying no, right? All the stuff that, you know, I would just kind of get wrapped up in and build upon, no. We'll put that to the side, right? And then that goes on, right? In Sesshin, hopefully, that over time that tends to sort of subside, right? The really gross kind of things that we work with every day. And then more subtle stuff, more subtle constructs come up. Right? And we do the same thing. We look upon those. And we say no. We say no to those. And we keep looking. And we keep looking and we keep looking to see just how far down does this go? You know, how far down does it go? You know, and when we think we find a base, oh, this is how far it goes. We say no to that. We keep looking. We try to see, well, what is it all resting on? Is there a resting place? You know, I had a nice moment with my mom. She was hospitalized during this period. I think she had internal bleeding or something. And, you know, she was in the hospital, and I came to visit her. And she was, like, on her side looking out the hospital window, the window of her room. You know, I sort of come over there. She was looking out. I'm just seeing whatever, you know, some, like, you know, the roofs of a bunch of buildings and stuff. And I sort of look, and then she, at a certain point when I'm with her, she kind of points. And I look out, and there were these, one of the roofs, there was these, like, steam pipes. And steam, this white steam, was coming out. And look at her, and she said, I like that. I said, you like that? Well, you know when that comes out, I like that. You know. So when all the rest had fallen away, all the wonderful things that she saw on all her travels gone, right? When all of her accomplishments gone, right? When a lot of words were gone. She didn't know the word for steam. And when that was gone, right? That's what was left. Right? It was quiet. It was very still. Very simple. And it was wordless. Right? Going back to the poem. And it was okay. In her reality, she was just delighted. Throughout this session, Shugen Roshi has been sort of encouraging us to simplify. Right? From his opening remarks to the encouraging words he offered, I think it was yesterday, to his talk. I just heard a lot of, you know, encouragement for us to keep things simple, right? To put down the complications, right? To sit and breathe. And we need to do that. We need to keep it that simple so we can see all of this very directly. Right? Because if we don't, we're just seeing another construct. Right? And this is where it can get really, really tricky. Right? Even when we think, maybe I should say, you know, but precisely when we think that we are, you know, seeing like the bottom of it all, right? No, we're just seeing us thinking, right? That's all we're seeing, right? In the Perfection of Wisdom literature, in one of them, Manjushri offers a really wonderful image of a coin before it's stamped, right? And he said that, you know, before it's stamped, there's no sense in asking, is it real or counterfeit, right? You know, I thought that was a wonderful image. You know, but before a coin is stamped, there's no sense in asking how much is it worth, what's its value, right? What can I buy with it, Should I save it or spend it? What's it worth to me? In fact, at that moment, it's not even a coin. Right? Even that, right, doesn't hit it. Right? So what is pain before we stamp it as pain? Right? What is, you know, the light shining off the floorboards before we stamp it as light shining off the floorboards? I guess the only thing, advice I can give is, shh, right? Don't say a word, right? Because any movement of the mind at that point, right, will just create another stamp, right? We'll contaminate it, as Lynn says, and maybe we wouldn't use that word. We might say, you know, it binds us. That might be a word that we would use, right? It binds us to whatever word or construct we're seeing all this through at that moment, right? Just as I just wanted to give us some, just a little guidance maybe for people who are newer to Sesshin. One thing I've found that's really, really helpful for me is the show saimyo during liturgy, right? Especially when it's a slow one, right? Not when it's a teacher doing it. I really have taken up that as a practice for myself, right? Because, you know, as you probably know, the way we work with it, it doesn't mean anything, right? There's that meaning-making part of our mind, right? That part of our mind that, you know, that wants to, like, you know what the Heart Sutra is really all about, right? The identity of relative and absolute that's, like, cranking through, you know, trying to figure it all out, right? That part of our mind can't really do anything with the Sho Saimyo, right? So it's actually a perfect part of our practice to really enter this, right? Because you can't do anything with your brain with it, right? Isn't that wonderful, right? There's one part of this whole thing where, you know, your brain isn't going to help you. So so I really want to encourage you, if you're sort of newer to this, just to really enter, right? Enter each sound. Right, fully let it vibrate through you, right? And it takes practice, right? Because the tendency is to check out. Whatever happens in your zazen basically happens in the Sho Saimyo, right? Because, like in zazen, there's nothing for your brain to really work with, so it makes stuff up to work with, right? You start to drift, you start to wander, you start to look around, think about stuff, right? If you can just let all that go and just come right back, right? come back to it, right? It's a wonderful practice. And just as a quick, going back to that image of the coin before it's stamped, I just want to say a quick word about the context for that. This occurs in the, I think it's the Perfection of Wisdom, 700 lines. It occurs, the Buddha asks Manjusri. So this mind, this kind of open mind, is it vulnerable? And I don't have it with me, but I think the Buddha says something, you know, is it vulnerable to threats from the outside? Or something like that, right? And then in response, Manjusri says, this mind is like a coin before it's stamped. Right? It has no value. There's no asking if it's real or counterfeit. Therefore, it's not vulnerable to threats from the outside. Right? That context for it really just kind of has stayed with me, you know. You know, because it just speaks, you know, in some ways, you know, it sort of has struck me in the Heart Sutra that, you know, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is the one who's doing all that knowing, right? You know, how can she see all the suffering if she's just said, no eye? How can she hear the cries of the world if she said, no ear, no sound? Right? I think it really kind of comes back to this, right, that, you know, she can say, she can hear and see and respond to all that precisely because, right, she has said no to any of her constructs so completely that she's not vulnerable in some way. In some way, you know, she's very vulnerable, Right, she hears and sees everything, but not in that way, not in the way that, you know, she has to defend against. Right. You know, so somewhat, you know, in the last maybe month or a few weeks of my mom's life, her dementia had gotten to the point where she was basically asking me like the same one or two questions over and over and over again. And her favorite was like, you know, like, what did you have for breakfast? Like, she'd ask like the nursing home staff constantly, so what did you have for breakfast? What did you have for breakfast? What did you have for breakfast? Right? And so you'd ask like over and over and over again, like every minute basically she'd be asking that, right? And it was an interesting practice for me, right? Because it really had me practice, you know, what's it like when dementia has nothing to do with dementia, right? When trying to talk with my demented mom has nothing to do with trying to talk with my demented mom, right? When all of that are no longer what's there, right? Well, it was simply, what did you have for breakfast? Oh, I had eggs and toast. What did you have for breakfast? Oh, thanks for asking, Mom. Oh, I made some scrambled eggs, I made some toast, a little bit of peanut butter and jelly. What did you have for breakfast? Oh, I had a wonderful breakfast. You know, I had some nice eggs, I made some toast. What did you have for breakfast? Oh, I made some. Right. I was able to let each time be the first time. Right? Because for her, it was the first time. Right, at that stage in her life, and that was her reality, and I could let it be mine. Right? Because the whole load of what dementia is, right, the definition of it, my thoughts about it, the medical decisions I've had to make around it, my reactions to it, all of that, right, was muted. Right? It was muted. Right? And the only thing that was left was my actual lived experience of being with my mom at that time. You know, in one of the Perfection of Wisdom texts, it says, I think it's the Buddha who says this, he says, no one can hope to achieve the fruits of the holy life unless they patiently accept the elusiveness of the Dharma. And Dharma basically means everything in and everything out, all that, right? And, you know, because it's elusive because of our need to pin it down. Right? And every time we think we've pinned it down, well, we might have it, there it is, it eludes us. And, you know, Dokusan is a great place to see, right, what we've pinned and be, you know, having to work on it some more, right, to see how things elude us and to have to go back and work on it some more. So wherever we think we've landed, good place, bad place, wherever we are has nothing to do with that, right? So let's practice in that way, right? Let's really practice in a way that's open, right? That isn't limited by wherever we happen to land or happen to be or any of those, whatever we think that is. Well, I'm glad I was able to bring my mom into this talk. I just wanted to dedicate this talk to my mom, Saraswati Vasan. Wherever, whatever, however you are right now. Thank you, Mom. And thanks, everyone. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.